Nothing is Real, a Beatles podcast, is powered by Acast. Welcome to Nothing is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. Today is the second part of our discussion about the Beatles song Revolution. And we went down some interesting roads in part one, but we focused in mainly on the song that we came to know and love as Revolution 1, which was the White Album track. But as we all know, there are other versions of Revolution that we need to talk about today. And so in terms of timeline, you know, when we left things at the end of the last episode, Stephen, we were giving a very detailed discussion about the Irish tourism in the west of Ireland in 1968.
Yes.
when at the end of June 1968, John took the original mixes of the Revolution 1 album track off to Ireland to be played to people. But we need to maybe go back a little bit because, as we said in part one, Revolution 1 and Revolution 9 were born from the same 10-minute recording session, this take 18 of Revolution that originally got put down on May the 30th, 1968. So there's a decision made at the start of June to split this take 18 into Revolution 1 and Revolution 9. And there's a couple of key dates then for when we try and get what we now know as Revolution 9 off the ground. And the start of it is really to do with the sound effects, really.
It is. So if we go all the way back to June the 6th, this is really where work began, preparing the tapes, loops, sound effects that they were going to use on Revolution 9. This is also the day that they started work on Don't Pass Me By, but that took them up until midnight, and then they started building up these tape loops and sound effects. Mark Lewisohn describes these tapes as being some that John had brought himself, some that he had put together at home, others culled from Abbey Road collections. We've already talked about Yoko sort of wandering around with a tape player. So she's been playing tapes into the mix sort of live as they're recording. And John sort of acknowledges this is very much her influence, and he wants, you know, he'd heard her do this. He wanted to do it. You know, he's going to have one of his own.
So they're pulling tapes from lots of disparate sources.
Yeah.
There's the famous Abbey Road tape library, where if you need a tweeting bird or whatever, it's there. And then there's tapes that they are recording themselves and making themselves. And then there's what we might know today as sort of found music, or even if you're being very poncy, you know, sampling. It's a version
It's a version of sampling. And I suppose in one sense, this is something they'd done on Tomorrow Never Knows with music and backward loops. It's something they'd done on Mr. Kite, where they chopped up existing tapes of pipe organs and things and, you know, created a collage. But this is something different, where there's a very disparate source of tapes, and they're pulling all of these together, and then they're going to weave them into a track. And these aren't adorning a track. These aren't sort of an addition. This is the fundamental core of the track. Yeah.
Well, that's exactly it. Yeah. Whereas, you know, Tomorrow Never Knows, I mean, there are echoes of Tomorrow Never Knows where they're bringing in tape loops and going, what about this one? What about that one? But as you say, for those, it's, you know, Tomorrow Never Knows is still a song underneath it all. The tape loops are the track.
Exactly.
It's music concrete. Now, I don't know if you know about this, Stephen, but Paul has been known to say, and I quote, "People tend to credit John with the backwards recordings, the loops and the weird sound effects, but the tape loops were my thing." And it was nice for it to leak into the Beatles stuff as it did. He doesn't like to talk
I'd never heard that before.
Yeah, but apparently he was the one who was listening to Stockhausen before anyone else.
Okay.
And, you know, all of that.
He may be influenced Yoko. Perhaps Yoko heard some of these. It's intriguing.
Yoko might have been, heard the Carnival of Light tape, and that might have set her off.
it is. I mean, I suppose that, you know, I'm not going to make fun of Paul in the way that you are. It's appalling that you should diss Paul in that way. But
I'm not dissing Paul. That's terrible.
But I suppose the contrast here is Paul is doing these things. He's doing it at home. He's playing it to friends. He's not bringing it in. He's not suggesting that this should be a Beatle track or that this should feed through. It's back to that idea of Paul as the sort of pop side of things. John has been propelled by Yoko into this avant-garde, you know, and suddenly he becomes the prime mover in that direction. And I mean, I can understand it must be slightly galling for Paul, who starts off in this direction and starts dabbling in these things. But you know, he didn't take it forward.
No, he didn't really. He's no, you're right. He was using it as a, I mean, what's important is that it was in his palate, so to speak, or it was in his experience. And he is, you know, in that kind of 65 to 68 period, he's the man about town, taking it all in. Yeah. Absolutely. But he's still, you know, his way of outputting it is very, very different to John.
Yes. And I mean, Paul is using it to decorate songs. Yeah. John is, I suppose it's indicative of that sort of addictive aspect of John's personality. You know, he never does anything in a half measure. So he's completely throws himself into any drug that happens to be set in front of him. He's absolutely buys 100% into the Maharishi. In 1968, it's all about avant-garde music concrete. You know, he's not going to dabble in this. If he's going to do something, he's going to throw himself into it. That's not Paul's nature.
And so this June the 6th is, and I do love the notion of, you know, they come off the back of recording Don't Pass Me By, and they're like, and now we're going to do Revolution 9 and a 1 and a 2. But this is the night where they pull number 9.
Yeah.
Number 9. It comes out on that night, and it's from a Royal Academy of Music tape, and we don't know who that person is.
Yes, yes. No one seemed to be able to identify who that was. You think of the royalties.
I think it's kind of beautiful, isn't it? I think it's you know, one of the things about, you know, Revolution 9, maybe we can talk about the how people felt about it later on, but it really is a very good version of that kind of thing, that music concrete, that number 9 is such a hook. Even in a piece of music concrete, it has a hook.
I think that's really the fascinating aspect to this. This is a composition, and John is bringing his, if you like, pop sensibility, or that notion of, you know, a verse, a middle eight, you've got to have a chorus, then the middle eight, then the chorus comes back in, and you've got to have a hook. So he's bringing that instinct, that commercial instinct, to working in this. Lewison, I think, has compared this to Carnival of Light, which is just supposedly chaos. This is a this has a structure. It has a purpose. And I suppose in that sense, one, it betrays its origins as the back end of a song with a formal structure, but also it gives an insight into the fact that its composer is someone used to working in that 3-4 minute verse, chorus, middle eight, chorus structure.
And there's a bunch of sound effects collected that day, not just number 9, which is part of a larger sentence. This is number 9 megacycles, is apparently what he said. I could audition for that. There was other sound effects on the day that were varied, and I love the names of these sound effects. Vicar's Poems,
Queen's Mess,
Come Dancing Combo,
Organ Last Will Test,
Neville Club,
Theater Outing,
and Applause TV Jingle, which is, you know, you can try and guess, you can see
where some of those might be. It's like that Monty Python clip of little old ladies clapping, on a TV.
And some of these sounds actually end up on something that's kind of forgotten about, is that John's book In His Own Right is being put on at the Old Vic Theatre in London. It gets premiered on June the 18th, 1968. Victor Spinetti has adapted it for the stage.
Yes.
And part of these sound effects are going into that as well.
Yes, John is actually working very closely with Victor Spinetti around this time in putting it together. It was a short play, one of three, that was put on across an evening, and it was very well received. The other two weren't, but John's play was actually quite well received. And, you know, you sort of wonder why that has never been revived in any way. But my favorite anecdote is, I think I may be blaming the Evening Standard in the wrong. It may be the Daily Mail. They reported that John turns up for premiere of play with Bottoms Girl. So yes, Yoko is making her sort of public appearances now with John, and this is being remarked on.
Yes, it's all getting a bit weird and tabloidy, because that's what they're up to. So that's the 6th of June, and then the 10th of June is the next recording session. George and Ringo are not there, and John is doing more kind of sound effects, collaging, prepping for Revolution 9.
Yes, and there does seem to be this overlap between the play and the Revolution 9. You know, that there's just this this sort of squirreling away in the archives looking for tapes. George and Patty, Ringo and Maureen are flying off to Big Sur in California because George is appearing in a documentary about Ravi Shankar, and obviously Maureen there as well.
There for the ride. And the next day, there is a bit more work with John and Yoko putting together more sound effects for Revolution 9 on June the 11th. But that day, June the 11th, a Tuesday, is when Paul puts down his first recording for the White Album, which is just him doing Blackbird, which we touched upon in part one as well. And there's a film crew there filming some of these sessions. And, you know, man, I wish they'd filmed the White Album the way they'd filmed Get Back. Yeah. You know, imagine if we had like a 2-hour documentary of the White Album being recorded. That'd be super. But Paul, it is interesting that, you know, Paul's debut for the White Album isn't a big Penny Lane type number. It's a small acoustic ditty that he's recording by himself. And whether that's just expediency because George and Ringo aren't there, because John isn't just doing Revolution 9 on his own that day. He is involved in the recording of Blackbird.
Yes, I mean, he seems to be in the control room giving helpful advice as to how this might be arranged.
But it's the even though the 2018 re-release of the White Album tried to sell us as, oh, we're four lads having a great time again, you're also seeing in these initial weeks of the White Album sessions, they're not there, really. No. You know, some of them are missing. George is missing on day one. George and Ringo are missing here. And the next person to go missing is Paul. Paul then disappears.
Yes.
And he goes off to New York, and George comes back in.
Yeah.
This is where we get into, we're kind of a few days down the line here on June the 20th, and June the 21st is where we get the real collage, or the real putting together of Revolution 9 happens here. We have all these sound effects and clips on the day, but this is the heavy lifting to make Revolution 9 what it is.
Yes, and this is really John and George working together on this with Yoko. Jeff Emmerich remarks that this is one of the very few recording sessions ever that Paul wasn't present for. He describes, and again, this is part of my problem with this book, he says it was just John and a rather unenthusiastic George Harrison working on the track. But George has said, you know, it was great fun doing it. And it seems to me this is another example of Emmerich's slightly snide comments about George, and to a lesser extent about Ringo. Richard Lush was the second engineer, and he doesn't say that. He doesn't record any sort of lack of enthusiasm.
Hmm. And it's also, you know, Lewison says that, you know, George is enthusiastic, that, you know, George and John are doing this together, that, you know, it's on June the 20th where the number 9 sample gets laid down into the track itself. You look at Mark Lewison's Sessions book, you know, he's saying there's a load of other loops there, that there's a brief extract from A Day in the Life, the orchestral Day in the Life. There's a backwards mellotron. There's some chopped up symphonic piece, which I think somebody on the internet has put back together and identified.
Okay.
Which is nice. I'll find a link to that.
He also says Beethoven's Choral Fantasy, The Streets of Cairo, Schumann's Symphonic Studies, the final chord of Sibelius's Symphony No. 7. It's good to know that people are out there doing this research for us. And a tape loop that was used in Tomorrow Never Knows.
And George Martin saying, "Jeff put the red light on, heavily echoed and played repeatedly."
I have to say, I can't hear that, but I haven't,
takes many colours to make a rainbow.
I haven't gone looking for it. But the song, the chant, then there's that American football chant, "Hold that line, block that kick," which for years, yes, until I actually saw that written down, I had no idea what they were actually chanting.
Yes. So I think it's 45 different sound sources. And as we said, you know, this is methodical, intentional. There are happy accidents, yes, no doubt about it. But the, you know, it's not thrown together for the sake of being thrown together.
No, it's not. It's not just a random collection of sounds and so dialogue and vocals. There is, it is done with purpose. As you say, there are happy accidents. You can hear the tape rewinding at one point, but they're actually down on the studio floor reading out those, like the Watusi, the twist, financial imbalance, those words that just grew. So George and is down on the studio floor with John and Yoko, and they're reading these out, or they're just making them up as they go along.
I did love that moment when George comes in, El Dorado. El Dorado. Some other ones that you can't hear on the tape. John says personality complex, onion soup, industrial output. I don't recall hearing those. We know where he says, "Take this, brother, may it serve you well." But they're having a lot of fun with this, and they're running it through tape echo, and it's as we said, all appended onto the back end of that original recording from May the 30th.
Yeah, and you can hear, I think it's on the YouTube mix of Take 20, you can hear John at the end saying, "We'd better listen to it, hadn't we? You know, we better."
Yeah, they're still enjoying it.
Yeah, there's no sense that this is anything other than a fun session.
Yeah, and Paul is not there, as we said, and you wonder, is that,
well, as I say, it's a fun session. Sorry, I couldn't resist.
But you do wonder, is that a bug or a feature, so to speak? That are they doing this because he's not there, or because he's not there, they're like, well, we can't do anything that needs a bass on it, so, you know, we'll just tug away at this.
Do you not think there's an element of, you know, when the cat's away, it's like, you know, the headmaster or the teacher is out of the room, so we're just going to, you know, do this, that we couldn't do this. I mean, they couldn't have done that if Paul was there, do you think?
I think Paul knew that this was going on, I assume. Like, he must have known, you know, on the Blackbird Day, there was a little bit of Revolution 9 work going on. And I'm sure Paul didn't know this wasn't happening.
But
maybe he wasn't expecting 8+ minutes.
I mean, I you can't imagine that he thought this was going to end up on the LP. You know, as I say, John at this time is working on other things. He's doing experimental films with Yoko. He's working on the In His Own Right play, which requires loops and soundtracks and sound effects. So maybe Paul is thinking, well, what's going to happen here is this'll be one of John's side projects, you know?
Yeah. And this is Thursday, the 20th of June, is this big session. It goes on from 7 p.m. in the evening till 3:30 a.m. in the morning. And they're back in the following day, Friday, the 21st of June. And this is the date, the recording we talked about in the last episode, where they do all the horn overdubs and George does his...
For Revolution 1.
Revolution 1. But there's also some mixing done to Revolution 9. Mm. It kind of gets its stereo mix where it goes, you know, number 9 from side to side, all that kind of final studio mixing bit gets done there, really trying to, you know, we said that it's a sound collage that has a momentum and a story, and he's using the stereo field to actually drive the story. Stereo really becomes Revolution number 9. It's not one of those things you have to hear in mono.
Yes. So, I mean, Lewison describes this mixing session saying John had a marvelous time pushing things across the stereo spectrum. George Martin's there, Jeff Emmerich, Richard Lush is there, and the second mix is The Keeper. So they it's done pretty quickly.
Yeah, and there's a bit more work done the following June,
the
25th,
yeah.
the following Tuesday after the weekend. And this is that weekend after they come back from their sojourn to the west of Ireland.
So,
so they come back and they tinker. We don't really know whether they brought Revolution 9, a working mix of Revolution 9 with them, or
I
we
would,
think it's just Revolution
I
9.
Would love to think they had taken and played that for the good folk of Mulrani.
Yes. Did he say what, Tuzi?
Yes. On the 25th, they actually then shave sort of 45 seconds off the mix from the day before and take it down to 18:15. Still the longest Beatles track.
Still the longest Beatles track, and a tiebreaker question at the Beatle Brain of Ireland, you'll recall.
Yes.
Very important moment in history. But this leads to what I love, which is at some point, and we're not totally sure of the day, but at some point, all the Beatles are back in Abbey Road and Paul gets played Revolution 9.
Yes. Again, that's another day you would want to be a fly on the wall.
And I doubt if he was tapping his fingers along with the beat on the edge of the Studio 2 console.
Well, we have, again, an eyewitness report from Jeff Emmerich, and again, pinches of salt should be applied, but he says that all four Beatles were there. John is proudly playing this, and he says, I'm going to quote, "I could see from the dark cloud that came over Paul's face that he was totally underwhelmed with Revolution 9 when he first heard it, and there was an awkward silence after the track faded out. Paul's only comment was, not bad. Ringo and George Harrison had nothing to say about the track at all. They looked distinctly embarrassed, and you could tell that neither one of them wanted to get caught in the middle of this." Hmm. So take that with a pinch of salt, I think, you know.
Not bad has echoes of nice motive.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
At the anthology project. But, you know, Lennon, according to Jeff Emmerich, you know, not bad. This should be the next single. You don't know what you're talking about. He gets all... you know, I think it's great. And then Yoko apparently thinks it's great
as
well.
Yeah, this should be our single. I agree, John. Which probably yeah. helps smooth things.
Yeah, well, there is Richard Lush, the tape operator, also says, you know, in Lewis and Sessions' book, he says, you know, Paul was in America when John did Revolution 9. I can't recall exactly what happened later, but I know it didn't get a fantastic reaction from McCartney when he heard it. That's probably a bit more
balanced. Yes.
Yes. And still is a grain of
he
truth.
Was a he was a balanced engineer.
Hey, great mixes. So, yeah, that certainly the nub of truth in this is that Paul wasn't chomping at the bit to big up Revolution 9 and probably felt it was, you know, guys, we've been doing an album for a month.
And this is what we've got.
Yes, this can't be the single.
You've got to think, you know, if Revolution 1 had been the single and Revolution 9 had been the B-side, you know, the slow version. You know, was
but the Beatles never really did a slow single.
No,
you know,
was John really pitching it as a kind of?
Well, obviously, a single was always on the cards. Like, what is the next single?
Mm.
And there's no sense with the White Album that there was a pressure the way there was with Pepper to say, "Well, give us a single, hive off a single."
No.
And I think they were rummaging around trying to see themselves what would emerge as the next single. And Revolution 1 is the catchiest, most provocative original song that they have
sure.
so far. They're a month into the album and they haven't done much. And, you know, this, as we've said, you know, the album sessions began on the 30th of May. It's only on the 3rd of July that Paul brings in a song for all the Beatles to play on and records his first song for the album, which is Obladi Oblada. And you would wonder at that point, is he saying, this is a single?
Yeah.
You know, this is one for the mums and dads.
This is a hit.
This is a hit. And it turns
it
out to
a
be
hit,
a hit.
Yeah.
And it was a hit for Marmalade, and he still plays it live in gigs now. So
And
they spend a long time teasing out Obladi Oblada in many different versions
yeah.
At the start of July. And you wonder if the threat of an Obladi Oblada single is what gives us Revolution, i.e.
the
B-side hard
yeah.
rock and version of Revolution. Because once they spend about a week and a half sort of trying to figure out what's going on with Obladi Oblada, John decides, actually, I'm going to do Revolution. Yeah.
This is going to be the single.
Yeah, and I think he's trying to say that this is, yeah, that the in the battle for the single, that's my theory anyway, is that this is why we get this extra version of Revolution. And because Obladi Oblada gets a remake, Revolution gets a remake. Maybe it's political, maybe it's petty. I don't know what it is. And they start this on the 9th of July, but these sessions are mainly wiped.
Yeah, this seems to be, July the 9th seems to have been a rehearsal. And sort of sketching it out in this new arrangement. It seems to be, from what Lewison describes, pretty complete in the sense that, you know, there's vocal tracks, there's double tracked a couple of words, it's pretty spontaneous. But yes, then the next day, the 10th, they go in and everything from the day before is wiped. The one point that we should maybe send people off to look at is that Pee Wee Creighton song.
Oh, yes.
Do Unto Others.
Do Unto Others.
Which, if you people haven't heard it, it is identical opening riff to the B-side version of Revolution. And this is a sort of a blues singer. I had never heard of him in any other context than this. This song dates from 1954. And you've got to think, how did they know this song?
Yeah, it sounds the exact same.
This suddenly just popped into someone's head on this particular day. This is the way to do it. I mean, it is a direct lift from the song. Yeah. It cannot be coincidental. But it's not the sort of song you imagine they were listening to in 1954.
Yeah, well, they would have been quite young at that point. So how it came onto their, you know, their radar, I don't know. There is on the White Album 2018 box set, there is a rehearsal take of Revolution, which I think has been found from the 9th of July sessions. It's an unnumbered rehearsal before we get to the instrumental backing track. But that work is mainly done, as you say, on July the 10th. And that's when, you know, they record the hard rocking version, including the opening scream that launches the song, happens on the 10th of July as well. And then there's more recording the following day on the 11th of July when Paul overdubs his bass. And we get a fantastic appearance from an acclaimed session man,
Nicky Hopkins.
Hopkins. Yeah. Tell us about Nicky Hopkins.
Nicky Hopkins, as you say, session man from the 60s. He's all over the place. He is coincidentally on Street Fighting Man at the same time.
That is a great coincidence that he is the linking part between both of those songs.
He recorded with the Kinks between 65 and 67, 68. On Village Green, he says he did pretty much all the keyboards, maybe 70%, but very annoyed when Ray Davis said it was him. He played on every Rolling Stones album between 1967 and 1981, Tattoo You, except for Some Girls. He was in the Jeff Beck group. He's literally played on everything. If you listen to the very distinctive piano on Angie, for example, 1973, he's on Living in the Material World. He's a bit like Billy Preston. He sort of is in between the Stones camp and the Beatles camp. He's appearing on solo albums, George and Ringo appearing in his solo albums. He was never in particularly good health, which is why he never joined the Stones as a touring keyboard player.
They had Ian Stewart hiding behind a curtain for enough years as well.
And he died sort of early at the age of 50 in 1994. The one contribution that I've never heard, he recorded some piano for L. Ron Hubbard and his Scientology albums.
That's a gap in your L. Ron Hubbard collection.
It is. It's a gap in my collection.
Don't summon the hordes. he was a great session player, a great keyboardist, Nicky Hopkins, and he plays that fantastic keyboard solo in Revolution. Yeah. It's an unusual thing for a Beatles record to have a rock and solo like that, and it almost predates the kind of Billy Preston vibe that we get six months later. This kind of very soulful yet rocking, where you can feel the player coming through the piece itself.
Yeah. And I mean, it is very distinctive. It's not something I think even Paul could have pulled off.
Yeah. And there's a little bit more tweaking on the 12th of July and the 13th of July, where they're working a bit more on this B-side hard rock version of Revolution, which at this point has to be in the contention now for being a single.
Yes.
It's a really striking, fantastic song. And they finally do a mono mix of it on the 15th of July. It's interesting that it doesn't get a stereo mix at that point.
No.
It's just this mono mix. And we might talk for a second, because that mono mix is really the best way of hearing the song.
I think so. I mean, it's just a great slab of noise. It is fantastic.
And the stereo mix, which you're probably all familiar with, has a very, like, it still sounds great, but it really spreads out the instruments left and right and takes away a lot of the immediacy. I was very upset that we didn't get a stereo remix of Revolution in the 2018 box set. It is one of those songs where the stereo needs to be made mono.
But do you not think the mono mix is good enough? You need a Sgt. Pepper.
I need a Sgt. Pepper overhaul. And I know a guy who tried to fix it in GarageBand to take the mono and the stereo versions and to overlay them and match them up and do his own mix, but he couldn't get it to work. Who has the time to do something like that? Certainly not me. But I know that John in later years gave out about that stereo mix, because that was done at the end of 69 for the Hey Jude
LP,
and he never really liked that stereo mix at
all. He said they turned it into ice cream.
Yeah, and he meant that in a bad way, because normally ice cream's so we have this version of Revolution now in the bag, which is in the running potentially for a single. It's got a nice mono mix, and they get recording for the rest of July, but obviously the song that becomes the single gets its first airing on the 29th of July, which is Hey Jude.
Yeah.
And what's to just talk about Hey Jude for 60 seconds, because this isn't the Hey Jude episode, but it is great that John realized straight away that Hey Jude was the single, that Hey Jude was the song, that Hey Jude was head and shoulders above everything else that they had. They had about 8 songs in the can at this point, that is the one.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, he never, he complains about Hello, Goodbye, I Am the Walrus. There's no complaint about Hey Jude. I think he realizes, as you say, immediately that Hey Jude is the superior song and should be the A-side.
And did you know, Stephen, when Paul was writing that song, shoulders, and
you what?
John said that's the best line in it, and all you, the rest.
I said he was going to change it apparently, but John said he won't.
That's the best line in it. Paul has given one big interview this summer to GQ magazine at the time of recording.
I read that interview today,
and it's quite a good interview.
It is a very good interview.
But it's labeled as his most in-depth yet. And he tells the Hey Jude story of John says that's the best line in it, And it's okay for him to tell the story. I'm still amazed that there aren't sub-editors around the world who just snip it out. Just go, we know that.
You know, if you go to see Paul in concert, you want to hear the greatest hits. You read the interviews, you want to hear the greatest. You want to read the greatest hits.
When he's talking, you want him to say the greatest hits. This is true.
Stop dissing Paul. It's my job.
I wouldn't diss Paul. But Hey Jude wins the battle for single, and Revolution becomes the B-side. But I think, and we've said this before, that is the single that should have been a double A-side single, without a shadow of a doubt.
Yes.
And, famously, the Apple store gets closed and Paul writes Hey Jude Revolution on the whited out windows of the vacant Apple store, which causes a bit of hassle. But right back at the start of part one, we talked about this notion of the voice of a generation.
Mm.
And so the first version that people get to hear of Revolution is the B-side version. And the B-side version has the lyric, when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out?
Yeah.
Boom. End of.
Yeah.
He doesn't say out in. So he records out in first. But of course, the album version of Revolution doesn't come out until the end of November, when the White Album comes out and Revolution 9 comes out. And it's the 22nd of November when it comes out. So when the Hey Jude Revolution single comes out, it is the 30th of August, 1968. And, we should probably talk a little bit about the reception that Revolution gets at this time, because we've had all this chaos and upset and upheaval in 1968. We have this concept of there are voices of a generation, and John, out of all four of them, you know, they're not waiting to see what Paul is saying. They're waiting to see what John is going to say, maybe
yes.
And so Revolution comes out. It doesn't really get the radical acceptance.
No. We started at the beginning of episode one on talking about what was happening in 1968 in that kind of tumultuous year. John is also raising his own personal profile across the year with Yoko in terms of starting to do events. He's planting acorns for peace. So his profile as a spokesman is on the rise. But yes, when this comes out, you've really... there's a lot of focus on the lyrics. So suddenly you have, Time magazine are looking at the lyrics. You've got The New Yorker, you've got Grail Marcus. It's not so much about the music, it's all about these lyrics. And John is expected, I suppose, by the new left, particularly in the UK, to be their spokesman and to be in sync with what they're doing. But actually the critical reaction is pretty scathing. Saying this is the New Left Review called the song a lamentable petty bourgeois cry of fear. Alan Wilson in The New Yorker said, it reminds me of the man who refuses a panhandler and then can't resist lecturing him on the error of his ways. It takes a lot of chutzpah for a multimillionaire to reassure the rest of us that everything is going to be all right. The change your headline is just an up-to-date version of Let Them Eat Cake. So it's
wait until that woman hears Imagine No Possessions.
I know.
She's going to explode.
So it's really poorly received by the very people that you imagine that John was hoping to please with this.
My gosh. And are you saying that the new left in 1968 cancelled John Lennon? Goodness.
Yes. If that had been a thing, they didn't. What they did was they engaged with him.
Yeah.
So he suddenly becomes the target of these sort of groups, and there's a New Left magazine at the time called Black Dwarf, which apparently, I had to look this up, took its name from a 19th century radical paper of the same name, which was first published in 1817. And Black Dwarf in the 60s asserted its continuity with its predecessor by numbering its first issue, volume 13, number one. But they published a long article, an open letter. A guy called John Hoyland wrote in Black Dwarf. Now, he, on the 50th anniversary of 1968 and the sort of May Risings, there was a South Bank program about that. There was The Guardian, naturally, published a piece on the 50th anniversary of the Grosvenor Square March. And Hoyland revisited this sort of experience where he says now, you know, very pompously, he wrote saying... in the same issue as featured the handwritten lyrics for Street Fighting Man that Jagger had written for them, he writes saying, we're confronted with a repressive, vicious, authoritarian system. Can you see what's wrong with your song Revolution? This record is no more revolutionary than Mrs. Dale's Diary, which is a very sort of anodyne Radio 4 serial on the BBC. He said, look at the society we live in and ask yourself why, and then come and join us. And he recalls that to his amazement, John writes back saying, your letter didn't sound patronizing. It was, who do you think you are? Who do you think you know? I know what I'm up against, narrow minds, rich, poor. I don't remember saying that revolution was revolutionary. You're obviously on a destruction kick, and I'll tell you what's wrong with the world. People, do you want to destroy them? So suddenly he's engaged in this war of words with the new left, and he finds himself at odds.
It's interesting, yeah. It's interesting to read all of this stuff and think about all this stuff, considering what's going on in the world as of late, you know, that the new left were unhappy, the far left were unhappy with them because they thought it was a betrayal and they thought it didn't go far enough. The far right were suspicious of the Beatles because they thought this sort of what was seen as a moderate cop to revolution was, you know, warning the Maoists not to blow the revolution by pushing too hard. So they still thought it was a coded message to the far side of the left, and John is kind of in a damned if you do, damned if you don't. But, you know, if we think things like, and I really, really hate terms like cancel culture and political correctness and all the rest. I think they reek of a lack of imagination. But, you know, these things are not new.
No. No, and it is this idea. I mean, it's difficult to see or to think who before John Lennon, in terms of, you know, singers or popular entertainers, is being asked for their political opinions in this way. You know, you would have had actors and singers before, you know, making political endorsements. You know, I support such and such a candidate or so. But actually, this level of engagement is something new. And what Hoyland says at the time, when he was writing a few years ago in The Guardian about this, he said there was this tension still between 1967, All You Need Is Love, and the rioting on the streets. And there were people he recognizes, you know, there were people who had a foot in both camps, but there was that tension. What actually happens with Lennon is then that he actually runs towards the new left. So over the next couple of years, he starts to embrace that. And, you know, he's marching in the streets. He's coming up with the Power to the People single, which actually quotes the lyric from Revolution.
Yes.
So he runs towards that. But then by the end of his life, he's kind of shifted back again.
Well, you know, you talk about, you know, who was going to speak, or who was expected to speak. And I think people were looking at these voices of a generation. And if Dylan had stepped up to be explicit about these things the way Lennon was, people would have listened to him. The point was, nobody was saying it. And I think John realized he was pushing an open door, so to speak, that, you know, and the more he could speak about it, the more people would want to listen to him. And in the aftermath of Revolution, and this kind of interaction that he's having with different political groups, you can see that he's inoculating himself for the Bed-ins for Peace, for, you know, what he talks about, you know, when he sort of evolves into being this advertising campaign for peace, or this advertising campaign for advocacy in general. It starts here with this song.
Yes.
And he seems to get a taste. You know, there's a lot of new that's happening in John's life in 68. And, you know, Yoko is part of that, but also engaging in some of these issues and realizing that people will listen to what he has to say about them. He's willing to chase it and to engage. You know, as you say, he does change his mind one way and the other. And, you know, he's got, you know, to use the phrase, he's got strong opinions loosely held.
Yes,
you know?
Yes. I think this is it. Back to this point where we were saying he has that addictive personality. He's either all in or all out. So he does the Bed-ins. It is all about peace. He's carrying that forward. And then suddenly he is, you know, he moves to New York. You've got Part of the People. You've got that sort of very strident anti-Nixon thing that he does in the early 70s, the whole of the Sometime in New York City album. But then he's back. By 1980, he's saying, you know, don't expect me to be on the barricades unless it's with Flower. So he's tapping back sort of full circle again into that. But you're right. It's provoking a dialogue is the key. The key, and but you can sense the shock that he felt, that the people that he felt, I suppose, were his audience and his natural fan base.
You dug up an interesting interview that he gave at the end of 68 with a student at CUNY University, called Morris Hindle.
Yes, this is a really interesting thing. This guy, Morris Hindle, as I understand it, was a student at Keele University. He was working on the paper, and they were all sent away and told, you know, think of ideas for an interview. What would be? And he just got in touch with John Lennon. And this was in December 68, and John invited him down to his home, and he spent 6 hours doing an interview, and a little tiny snippet ended up in the student magazine. There's bits and pieces of it have been published. I think it was the New Statesman. Tantalizingly, Morris Hindell has been saying for about 10 years that he's working on a book. It even has a title, Singing His Heart and Speaking His Mind, The Song World of John Lennon. That was in 2010, but we're still waiting. But the bits that I have read are actually very revealing. So he's talking about, you know, we had to become the mop tops to get where we are, but there's lots of changes. I'm doing the same thing I was doing at school or art school. You've got to don't drop out, stay in and subvert the system from the inside. And that seems to be the message. But I really want to hear this whole interview. I want to see this book. Now, what I would say is there is a podcast on SoundCloud called Morris Hindell Remembers, which is really him talking about the experience, and it's a very interesting listen.
If you must listen to
if
other
if
podcasts.
You do have to listen to other podcasts.
what I like about that interview is, you know, John says, you know I've compromised, to stay in and subvert it, is the message, and that feeds back into, you know, agreeing to get into a suit, know, back in the Beatles days. It's all the same sort of attitude, and I think that's totally understandable that he walked that tightrope of, you know, what do I do to get attention, to get notice, and maybe in some other point in time it'll be, oh, I'm going to send an acorn to this world leader, you know, or late in the 70s, oh, we're going to take out a full page ad in the papers. That, you know, he's very aware that it's not that to say he's playing a game makes it sound very cynical, but he's well aware that he has to sweeten the medicine.
Yeah, and it is all back to that line. You know, you're not going to get anywhere carrying pictures of Chairman Mao. You know, if you are too radical, if you are too outspoken, if you are too, I suppose, pure in your ideology, you're not going to get elected, and then you can't do anything. So then you have to make a compromise to actually get into the system. Welcome to Politics Today.
Welcome to Politics Today, but the message of compromise versus political purity is one that rages truer than ever, I'd have to say. Obviously, though, the sad point is that, well, not the sad point, but this single comes out in the end of August. 30th of August is when Hey Dude Revolution comes out, and it's the end of November when Revolution 1 comes out. And at that point, even though You Can Count Me Out In was recorded first, it seems 4 months later, it must have seemed to people at the time that, oh, that's a cop now. He's changed his mind. He's gone into revolution.
Yeah, that's absolutely the way it was perceived at the time. And my favorite response, I'll not read out all the lyrics, but people should go and listen to Nina Simone's song.
Well, that's the most important response, because it's a musical response from someone who's very politically astute.
And, it's a direct, it paraphrases the lyrics of Lennon's song. And it's basically saying, you know, it's not as simple as talking jive, the daily struggle just to stay alive, singing about a revolution. Because we're talking about a change, it's more than just evolution. So it's a very direct musical response. And it's a great song.
So that's the political response. We might just wrap up our chat about Revolution, because there's a couple of different versions and mixes and things knocking around of the song. And one of the joys of the B-side version, Revolution, is that we got the promo film recording. And that was done on the 4th of September. And again, there's so little footage of 1968 Beatles. Those promos recorded ostensibly for David Frost for Revolution and Hey Jude, they're great snapshots of how they were at that time. It's hard to believe 4 months later they look so jaded. Whereas they still look very vital, and they still have
they look
the four-headed beast.
Yeah,
about them,
they look
know?
Great, and they're just the fact that they, you know, George turns up wearing a sweater, Paul's wearing his kind of lovely velvet jacket. I mean, they just were the four coolest people on the planet. At that particular time, you know?
And it's mad to think of, you know, when you see them singing the David Frost theme tune and being introduced by David Frost, it's so jarring to see them as guests on a talk show at that point. Like, that's the only thing they really did at that stage, post 65 or so.
Definitely is. I think you mentioned back in the 68, early 68 episode, it's the sudden disappearance of that four-headed press conference, the four-headed sort of interview is something to be you know, regretted. I mean, and this is an interesting little taste of that. So yeah, they record this film. They're overdubbing new vocal track onto the studio version, but you can hear Lennon's voice is playing in the background. So there's a slight sort of disconnect there. And Paul does the scream, and he and George bring in the shooby-doo-wop vocals.
So yes, you hear that.
It's arguably it's yet another version. It's a kind of hype.
It is yet another version. And again, I've heard of a guy who ripped the OnePlus DVD to get the alternate mixes and versions of those tracks.
Yeah.
Interesting guy.
Some guy.
So yeah, there's a promo film version. There's this stereo version that we talked about earlier on, the stereo mix, which is, you know, the ice cream, as you call it. The mono version of Revolution 1, I think, is that a fold down of the stereo?
That's just, they didn't do a separate mix. They just folded down both channels of the stereo mix.
Okay. And then it's in the Love album. Yeah. And there's the 50th anniversary, then remixes from the 2018 box set. But again, that's just the album version of Revolution 1 and Revolution 9. We don't get a 2018 remix of Revolution, unfortunately. No. And any other versions that are worth talking about?
There is the 5.1 mix.
Okay. That's on the box set.
I don't know if you ever, you know, I know a guy that sat in a darkened room listening to, that's extremely unsettling, but it is the way that song is meant to be heard. Giles Martin just really, I keep saying repeatedly, I'm not a big fan of 5.1 mixes. But this song just takes it to another level. They are clearly just having fun spinning the sound around the room.
So let me ask you a personal-ish question, which is when you first heard, I want to focus particularly on Revolution 9.
Yeah.
What was your take on Revolution 9, or when did you meet the White Album?
I would have been 15 or 16 at school, because I remember you could record the whole of the White Album onto a C90 cassette tape if you left Revolution 9 off. So that's probably the way I would have been listening to it, having recorded onto cassette. I think I can say, hand on heart, I have never not played it. I've never skipped it when I was playing the vinyl, and I've never skipped it. You know, even if I'm in the car and I'm listening to the White Album and it comes on, I will let it play. So I honestly don't remember being shocked by it. What about you?
I was a
callow youth.
The White Album.
A callow youth.
I was a callow youth. The White Album was something I think I mentioned before. I bought it on CD at the end of 1988 with like a record token or something for a long car journey. And I knew it was the album that had all the weird, freaky stuff attached to it. And what I kind of remembered in retrospect, that I think I bought the White Album because I just bought Rattlin' Hum from U2. And that had Helter Skelter on it.
Okay.
The definitive version. And so I bought the White Album, and I already owned Pepper in a compilation in that, but the White Album, I was like, well, there's so many songs here that I really don't know. Like, this doesn't have She Loves You on it. What the hell are all these songs? But I knew that Revolution 9 was this kind of fruity thing. Yeah. And I was unsettled by it. I didn't like it. And because I was a child of the CD, it did get skipped. I went through a phase where I just couldn't listen to it. I didn't want to listen to it. It was kind of ugly. And then about 10 years ago or less, I had to drive in the middle of the night from Dublin to Kerry, which is, depending on how fast you go, it should be about a 3.5 hour drive. And I think I did it in a lesser time than that. But it was about 2 a.m. It was I was driving on my own. It was a very bright night because there was a full moon and a clear sky, and Revolution 9 came on the stereo and there was nobody on the road, and that was the best way to ever hear Revolution. I thought, this is just fantastic. And again, with the mixes from the 2018 box, I don't, you know, I skipped it for years and years and years, and I don't skip it now. I think it's fantastic, and I think it's a fantastic version of the thing it's trying to achieve, which is a form of music concrete. It is a story, and it's just part of the Beatles' arc. It's just one of the bricks in their wall, and it's as important as the rest.
Absolutely, and I mean, I absolutely agree with that, and it is you know, arguably the most subversive thing they ever did. Mm. And I think it's in David Quantick's book on the White Album, which if people don't have that book, they should buy that book.
Yeah, it's called Revolution.
He talks about the fact that this sort of, you know, a million houses over the world suddenly disappears, is dropped right into the middle, sort of, you know, the middle of family life, of middle class, you know, yeah. America, middle class, England. And it's completely subversive, and no other group could do that. And as you say, it's an integral part of the album, and it's an integral part of the Beatles' story.
And again, it feeds back into that thing that John was saying, that, you know, you know there are certain compromises you make in order to deliver the thing you're trying to deliver. So, you know, they will deliver the other songs in order to get you to a point where Revolution 9 is there. It's fantastic. I think what we'll end off on saying, though, is that if you are going to listen to the track Revolution, there's one version that stands above all other
versions.
There
is, and this is something I mentioned to you just before we started recording, which is the worst cover version ever of Revolution. And completely independently, with no collaboration, we had arrived at the answer, which is...
1, 2, 3,
Thompson Twins. At Live Aid.
At Live Aid with Madonna.
Yeah. It's awful.
I mean, I think they changed the lyrics to "We all want to feed the world" and all that kind of stuff. And it's, you know, it sounds like a great idea. You know, they're having a revolutionary concert and, you know, the bad boys of tepid mid-80s pop, the Thompson Twins, are there to deliver a message. And you know, you think, yeah, Revolution, this is a musical revolution, let's deliver Revolution. But it's very frustrating, and, you know, it's just terrible.
It's just awful. If anyone out there knows of a worse version, please don't get in touch.
Keep it to yourself, that's fine. But, you know, to paraphrase 2020 Bob Dylan, the Beatles contain multitudes. And even within a single song like Revolution, it contains multitudes in terms of what it delivers and what it gives. I think we've covered an awful lot of those angles
today. I think so.
But what do you think, everybody? Revolution, where do you stand? We're always available for a bit of a chat in the usual places. We're on Twitter, at Beatles Pod. Stephen runs the Facebook group, the Nothing Is Real Facebook group, so ask to be let in. And wherever you get your podcasts, if you want to leave us a nice review, that's always appreciated. But for now, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thank you for listening. Nothing Is Real is powered by Acast.